You're listening to The Point. Can you name a teacher from elementary or high school? If you can, it's likely one that made an impression on you, hopefully in a positive way. Good teachers can make a world of difference for students, not just in the classroom, but on the sports field, in the hallways, and during the difficult social and emotional situations that arise in adolescence. Today, we talk with a teacher who is devoted to his students and to improving the public education system. He's an English teacher at New Bedford High School and the 2020 Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. Takeru Nagayoshi, welcome to The Point, and congratulations on being Teacher of the Year.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
So how long have you been teaching, and why did you gravitate toward this profession?
It is going to be my sixth year in the classroom, and to be completely honest with you, teaching was not something that I had on my radar. I was not academically successful growing up for the most part. I lived in Japan when I was in fourth grade and stayed there until the eighth grade, and the work there was difficult being a Japanese language learner. And so I had told myself, I'm not going to ever be in education. But it wasn't until I came back to the States and I had wonderful teachers like my history teacher, my English literature teacher, who have really leaned on the idea of amplifying student voice and recognizing who you are. And so I think, or I'd like to think, I'm following in their path and trying to recreate those experiences for my students.
They inspired
today.
You, and now you're trying
they
to
did.
Inspire
you
the
know,
next
it's,
generation.
It's a pay it yeah. forward model.
Yeah, you're a self-described openly gay person of color. When did it become apparent to you that it was important to discuss these aspects of yourself with your students and colleagues? Mm. And what has been the value in doing so?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of some people say that, you know, you're who you are and things like identity, race, don't have space in the classroom. And when I first started teaching, I had thought it was the professional thing to do to not talk about my race, to not talk about my sexual orientation in the classroom, because personal and professional boundaries should be met. I think there is a folly in that thinking because, A, that's not something that we can demarcate. Kids can see the fact that I'm Asian. I have to talk about, you know, what I did over the weekend with my partner. And so being authentic and true to who I am was something that I wanted to lean in on for investing in kids and having a sense of real relationships with them. But I think a big turning point was when the Pulse shooting happened a couple of years ago. And, you know, for context, a lot of LGBT persons were killed at a nightclub in Florida. And it was a year that there were many mass shootings. And this one really struck an additional chord with me because it was so targeted towards identity. And so I felt the importance of being out, not just for my LGBT students, but to also non-LGBT students, creating a sense of, you know, there are people with different perspectives and different identities that all make up the community that we're part of. And if we're not honest about having these conversations, then we miss an opportunity to talk and reach out to who we are.
Teachers in Massachusetts are predominantly white. Why do you believe it's important for there to be more diversity in a teaching staff? And what are your thoughts on how we achieve that diversity?
Yeah. As an Asian teacher, I think there's only like 1% of us. And then teachers of color only represent like 8%. And yeah. So 90% of educators are white. There's a lot of research actually that says, you know, there's this role model effect when educators of color are in the classroom. And that leads to better academic outcomes, that leads to lower behavioral referrals. And students of color feel a sense of connection and investment in the schoolwork that they're doing. I also think it's important for different perspectives and identities to be represented in the classroom because, you know, quite frankly, a lot of how our education system is built around is on white middle class values. And that sort of monolith of an experience tends to be alienating yeah. to a lot of kids who don't share that cultural context. And, you know, things as simple as a white teacher who doesn't have the cultural competency to understand their students of color and how they're reacting as quote unquote acceptable mm-hmm. behavior can have long term consequences in that learning trajectory and outcome of that child. And mm-hmm. and so for me, having educators of color is a matter of having our students see adults who look like them in the yeah. classroom and who are able to support and to love and to care for them. And then the second part of your question is about how.
Yeah, how we achieve
how
it.
Do we?
Yeah.
So yeah.
You know, just speaking to what you were just talking about, mm-hmm. I was reading an article about Boston schools and in a particular school where I don't remember what subject he taught was a black teacher, and how a lot of the black students hang out in his classroom
yes.
a lot. And they were saying because they feel that is a safe place
yeah.
and that the teacher can identify with them. And they, as you're saying, let
me tell you, Mindy, I am the advisor for the Film Advisory Club. We have about like 25 students. 2/3 of them are Asian. You know, there's no, you know, that's not a coincidence. There is a sense of reassurance in seeing a person who looks like you, who can help you navigate what it means to be a minority in a white dominant space. I didn't have an Asian teacher until I was in college. And that limited my own capacity to see myself as an educator. Mm. And so diversifying that, I think, is super important.
Do you think teachers should be trained and willing to be more open about their personal experiences and identities with students as part of the education process?
I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what are some examples of how that could be done?
Leaning in on who you are and bringing those aspects to your full self. I talk a lot about being out in the classroom, for instance, and again going back to that story of thinking, hey, I don't want to mix my personal and professional life. I realized that being out in my classroom not only helped a lot of my LGBT students, but my non-LGBT students as well. And in particular, being open about my sexual orientation made straight boys be more willing to open up to some of the struggles that they were going through. And it sort of dawned on me. I call it the queer eye effect. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know that Netflix show.
Mm-hmm, I do, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But I think queer people in particular have a unique lens into understanding or actually confronting and disrupting the rigid hierarchies that exist in gender expression. Mm-hmm. And in a context where a lot of boys are told to be alpha, and told to express themselves in a certain way.
Boys don't cry.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Having a person, a male role model that says, actually, you know, those things are totally legitimate. That's fine if you're feeling these ways. And let's think about what it means to be empathetic, to listen to one another, and to break down those toxic, rigid structures of what it means to be a man or a woman or what have you. Right. Is freeing to a lot of students, I think.
New Bedford, like many communities in this region, has a large immigrant population. Mm. How has the national discourse on immigration impacted your students?
Ooh, that's a really hard one. I think it creates a sense of a lack of safety, I guess, if you will. I've had a lot of undocumented students in the past. I have students who don't know that their parents are undocumented. And I think when there's a cultural context in which talking about students who have different statuses are so hateful mm-hmm. in rhetoric and nature, it can create a sense that they're not being heard or listened to.
It's scary.
Yeah.
I mean, fearful. It's like, yeah. what's going to happen to me? Am I going to be deported?
Right.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Have you used immigrant rhetoric and policies as a teaching opportunity with your students?
So the class that I teach is called AP Seminar, and it's a research-based class. And so kids essentially investigate a topic of their own choosing, and they sort of use an academic lens to explore that. And so in that context, I've had a lot of kids who have family members who are immigrants explore that on their own. Mm-hmm. Explicitly, no. I think in more softer ways, mm-hmm. How, as a teacher, I think of what it means to disrupt the sort of criminalization of people who are undocumented and making sure that I'm checking language when kids say illegal. Mm-hmm. Undocumented. And trying to give as much context around policy and nuance mm-hmm. to, I think, what becomes really reductive yeah. arguments around immigration yeah. In this country.
You just said something that made me think illegal versus undocumented.
Yeah.
And you're an English teacher. Words matter.
It does.
Yeah, words matter.
It does. And specifically when we use the term illegal, mm-hmm. It is vilifying a group of people. It's also very ahistorical because if we say illegal, it almost implies that these humans are inherently so. And actually not. That wasn't the case if we're looking
at
it.
Not even just in this context. I mean, just in general, the way we talk to people and sometimes the like uncivility, if you will, that's in a lot of conversations and social media. Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes you see what people say and you think, oh my gosh, would you ever say this to somebody's face? You hope not, but yeah, words matter. So have you been surprised about reactions to the social and political times from your students? Have you been surprised at their reactions? Or are they what you might expect?
I have been surprised by some of the things that I would hear. I had a student come in, say that another student told them to go back to China, for instance. Or, you know, even when kids are saying these things to be edgy, it does sort of have an impact on the kind of community that we're trying to build in our schools. And it's one thing for that kind of rhetoric to be coming from the students, but if we as educators are silent about it, if we're not intentional about creating academic context around why this kind of discourse can take place in our classroom, and if we're not reminding our kids that they are welcome, they are safe, I think that has huge implications on their sense of safety and investment in the school.
We're talking with Takeru Nagayoshi. He's the 2020 Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. If you'd like to join our conversation, 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. The norms around race, gender, and sexual orientation are shifting. Younger people are more open to these changes, but there's still discrimination and bullying towards those perceived as different. Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any shifts in student behavior in terms of bullying incidents and how students respond to those incidents?
I think there is a greater sense of urgency among students, and there's a greater sense that when we make certain jokes that are problematic in nature, we are starting to see, you know, at a national level, the broader implications of that. And so I taught Night from Elie Wiesel about the Holocaust for a really long time. And prior to the 2016 election and the rise of hate crimes and anti-Semitism in this country, to some degree, I think it felt a bit abstract to many of our students. But, you know, after Charlottesville, for instance, teaching it outside of the context of white supremacy in contemporary United States, teaching it outside of the context of the uptick in anti-Semitism is not an option. And so kids understand, I think, the relevance of the content that I've been teaching in the past. And they themselves are finding for ways to process that. And so going back to that research class I was talking about, from topics like, you know, sexual assault in the military to supporting students on DACA. Mm-hmm. A lot of my kids are looking at things like race, gender, sexuality, you know, those identity issues that oftentimes deal with bullying as a emphasis point in their academic work.
You know, when I was going to school as a kid, a lot of times when there was a bully, you know, everybody just kind of stood by and watched, right? Do you see kids standing up now more saying that's not acceptable? Does that happen? I mean, it seems to me that there's more kids are doing that are saying, you know, that's language
wrong, right?
Or that harassment, that's not acceptable.
They call it out. Yeah. I mean, being brave it takes a lot of courage,
sure,
right?
It does,
And to not be a bystander, even as an adult, I think is really difficult. Yeah. I'd like to think that kids these days have a greater mindset and, again, sense of urgency in having to disrupt and stand up to it. But at the same time, we as adults are still responsible in making sure that we're creating an environment and modeling the kind of language that kids can use to make those disruptions. In my classroom, I do see kids push back and you know, advocate for other voices that aren't always represented. Whether or not that transcends in the politics of the cafeteria or hallway, probably another issue.
You said a modeling, you know, modeling adult behavior, and you made me think of, I saw a cartoon, I think it was yesterday, where there's a mom and a kid reading a book on a bench, and next to them is another mom and a kid, and they're on their phones, and the mom on the phone is saying to the mom, "How do you get them to read?" That was funny. In years past, some New Bedford schools were rated as underperforming by the state, and many of those schools have improved in the rating criteria of test scores, attendance, and graduation rates. Before we talk about some of the underlying issues impacting school performance, explain what New Bedford has done so far to turn around school performance.
Yeah. I can speak from the teacher perspective. There has been a renewed commitment in making sure that a lot of the work that we do are grounded in research and evidence. There's a shared language increase in professional development time to make sure that we are giving the kind of instructional supports that our kids need. I think technology services, we have a one-on-one laptop initiative where every single kid has a computer, and that has been a godsend for my AP research class, for my kids to do that kind of work. A renewed commitment in a lot of the AP courses, and making sure that we as a district are being known as a place of academic excellence.
So what do you see as some of the underlying issues impacting school performance, and what kinds of reforms or programs would you like to see initiated?
Yeah, for me, it goes back to broader conversations of like what ed reform should be about. And I think there's this tendency for a lot of us to look at an underperforming school and say, hey, it must be the teachers, right? Or it must be the school leadership. And that's definitely part of the problem. But a lot of underperforming schools are, you know, it's part of a broader narrative of difficulties and challenges that happen in communities. And if you look at all our schools under turnaround plans and underperforming schools around the country, they are broader conversations to be had on systemic poverty, trauma that exists inside the communities, decades of policy that are inequitable. And, you know, in the case of New Bedford, us not attending to the linguistic and political needs that over 30% of our English language learning populations have. And so I would like to see a place where we are having conversations on ed reform that's not just focused on the school as a unit of change, but looking more holistically at the sort of systemic reasons behind why the systemic reasons that beget underperformance. Mm.
You mentioned poverty and trauma. Yeah. Those are big issues.
Big issues. Yeah.
I mean, how do you tackle that?
How
I mean,
with
poverty, I mean, it's great, obviously, that every kid can have a laptop. I mean, I guess there are programs, and, you know, there's, you know, the lunch, but, you know, you can't learn if you come to school hungry, right? Mm-hmm. And so there are some programs in place there, but that's a tough one.
Yeah.
It's even at the cost of living and, you know, what people are paid.
Yeah. And it's not politically convenient to touch either.
Yeah.
And so when we talk about ed reform and the things that could be done, a lot of the solutions, right, are what can teachers do, right? What can the schools do? But when we look at the research as to what creates underperformance, a lack of investment in schools, you know, for our school truancy and chronic absenteeism has been an issue. Like, a lot of those are tied to things that are happening at the home and community level.
Right. And then the trauma, you know, I mean, you have, you know, kids who are coming from maybe some dysfunctional families, and that's not something the school can really help with that issue, right? I mean, that's just, but again, I guess creating that safe place and being that role model does show those kids, you know, that there is a different lifestyle.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think rethinking as our role as educators, like, it's not just about academics. It's really about investing in the child as a whole and attending to and being aware of the social emotional needs that they have.
Right. We are talking with Takeru Nagayoshi. He's the 2020 Teacher of the Year, Massachusetts Teacher of the Year. He's an English teacher at New Bedford High School. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking with the 2020 Massachusetts Teacher of the Year, Takeru Nagayoshi. He is an English teacher at New Bedford High School. 866-999-4626 if you'd like to ask a question or offer a comment for us this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we've been talking a lot about how open you are with your students and conversations in the classroom. Not all teachers are comfortable doing that, right? So how do you, in your own school, do you encourage encourage other teachers to talk about things that are uncomfortable?
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's the goal, too. There's almost two schools of thought. And I think older generations, especially when it comes to sensitive topics like race, sexual orientation, there's this tendency to be like, nope, that is your personal life. You do not mix it with your professional. And I had a colleague of mine who would claim adamantly that like there is actually no place in the classroom to talk about race. And to backtrack a little bit, I heard or overheard this teacher talking to another student saying, hey, LGBT discussions don't have a place in the classroom. Keep that in the clubs, right? And after hearing that conversation, I approached that teacher later on and said, hey, I wanted to understand the context behind that and why you had that idea. And would you say the same thing about race as well? And this teacher proceeded to say, yes, even for matters of race, we don't talk about it unless it's in history during civil rights. And so at that point, I was like, wow, there is such a big chasm between our understanding of what these mean. But I think from this teacher, they were coming from a perspective of, I don't know if I have these conversations in the classroom, how they're going to be interpreted by kids, what the kids' parents might think about that. But my pushback to that is, well, A, these conversations about identity, race, they are sort of the subtext of what we teach. It's an inescapable filter that our students are already constantly bombarded with. And so would you rather have us, you know, informed practitioners, help kids navigate these conversations, model what it means to have conversations on sensitive topics in like a civic controlled environment? Or would you rather have them dredge up their talking points on YouTube or Twitter, which is exactly what's happening right now?
Yeah. The other thing, too, I'm wondering for teachers who might be uncomfortable with these conversations, there's also this, what if I say the wrong thing? Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to upset anybody in the mm-hmm. classroom. And if you're talking about race and you're a white teacher, you don't have the same perspective
right.
as a person of color would yeah. have. And so I could see where there might be some hesitancy to, you know, talk about something that you're not really an authority on,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the same thing goes for your practice as well. If there's something that you don't know about, then part of your obligation, I think, as a teacher is to learn about that.
Yeah. All right. So children are wired to learn. And in the early grades, students enjoy going to school and enjoy learning. For many kids, that joy begins to wane as they get a little bit older. Mm. It becomes a chore. So yeah. What are your thoughts on how we keep students engaged in learning, particularly in an era with such emphasis on test scores and state issued curriculum standards?
Yeah. And not to mention that we teachers are facing, you know, cell phones
right.
and there's so many distractions out there. I teach in a high school setting. And so that answer might look different for middle school and elementary school teachers. I feel for me, it's about making the learning authentic and relevant to who they are. And oftentimes our curricula is so siloed and so abstract that kids don't really care about, you know, identifying iambic pentameter in a Shakespeare poem. But if we're really thinking about the skills of critical analysis in a text and using evidence to support your claims, there's so many other vehicles to get to those skills with. And the question as an educator that I ask myself is, then is this particular Shakespeare sonnet the way to get there? And if there's other ways that I can get there that is more relevant to my kids' lived experience, to their burgeoning political consciousness, and if I can connect it to their community, to their identity, then why shouldn't I be doing that? You know, it's killing two birds with one stone.
Yeah. Researchers have been studying the role of tenacity and perseverance in achievement. Some studies suggest that those skills are just as important as academic achievement
yes.
when it comes to success later in life. Is there room in the public education model to teach and promote perseverance and tenacity?
Yes. I teach a class called AP Seminar. And part of why I love that class is because it's a project-based independent learning class. And so rather than kids being taught to test, to answer a multiple choice question at the end of the year, which is what my other class that I teach, AP Literature, is like, kids are essentially writing what's akin to a thesis, an undergraduate thesis. They are doing their own independent work. They are collaborating with each other. And at the end of the year, they need to submit a 2,000-word paper, give a 10-minute multimedia presentation, and an oral defense. And I think those types of assessment are inherently geared towards those soft skills that I think a lot of education in these past couple of days have been walking away from. And so I love the ability to use this research-based class as a vessel to reinforce resiliency skills, like what it means to, I don't know, time manage, to learn from the mistakes that you have, to look at each other ways of learning, and also using academia as a lens to process their world. And so again, going back to making content relevant and authentic to their experience. Yeah.
Let's talk to Steve, who's giving us a call from Centerville. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Mindy. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I really want to affirm everything that your guest is saying today. I've been listening to the show and I keep nodding my head and saying, yes, you know, this is a person who has won this award, and that really deserves some recognition. And particularly with being who you are, bringing your whole self to the classroom every day. And, you know, I'm retired, but I was a teacher from the 70s up through the present, and now I substitute teach. And it's really hard work. And mm-hmm. I really affirm what you're saying. And I know you're getting pushback from teachers, from administrators, from politicians all the time, but my experience for 50 some years is that what you're doing is appropriate and effective and makes a difference. And I'm sure this happens to you, that you had students come up to you who maybe you had 5 or 10 years ago who say, you know, thank you very much, Mr. because what you said that one day really made sense to me, and I changed my life. So don't despair. Keep at it.
Thank you so much, Steve.
Thanks, Steve, for calling and for saying that. Because I'm sure that is tough, right? Because not everybody would agree. But hey, you're 2020 Teacher of the Year from Massachusetts. Somebody's recognized that, right? All right, let's talk to Anne, who's giving us a call from Holliston. Hi, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Good. I wanted to just kind of add something in terms of what I think is a really nice inclusive environment. You're talking about sort of individuals or children in a community with varying backgrounds. Don't forget about the kids with disabilities.
Yes.
So especially children with autism, that's the population that I work with.
Yep.
And I think that the community is better for just on the whole. Everybody learns more, especially if the students with disability learn from peers as well as peers learn from them.
Yeah.
So I wanted your thoughts on that.
Thank you for mentioning that. That's absolutely a very important point.
I totally agree. I think the best kind of learning is the learning that teaches to all. And whether we are talking about our students with special needs or our English language learners, I think a good practitioner is like, the teaching that attends to those students is teaching that attends to all students.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate that. Steve was mentioning just about bringing your whole self to the classroom. And it's just made, I was thinking, and this is not just true of kids. People can they authenticity. You see, you know that, you know, mm-hmm. you say, you don't even have to say things. They know things without you telling them. So to be able to talk about that and be open in the classroom really kind of really creates a bond, right, with your students.
Yeah. I don't know what that quote is. It's like, they don't care. Students don't care about what you know. They care about like whether or not you care about. I'm butchering the paraphrase, but yeah, there's that idea of good teaching and good learning relationships are based off of care. Mm-hmm. And how can you have that authentic care,
right,
if
they
you're
know
not
if
bringing
you care.
Your
yeah.
authentic
yeah.
self?
Yeah. All right. New Bedford has a number of charter schools, particularly for middle and elementary age students. Proponents of charter schools maintain they're creating choice for parents and have a proven academic track record. Opponents see charter schools as spreading already limited education dollars too thinly and argue we should be focused on creating the best public schools to educate all students. What are your thoughts?
Ooh.
I know that's a tough one.
Yes, it's a very tough one. Well, as a teacher of the year, I am a teacher for all students. So, all teachers. Yeah. It's my diplomatic answer. But I think charter schools are a unique place for different types of education methods to be tested for. My partner works at a charter school. I have a lot of friends who have been there, so I know that good work does happen. But my entry into this conversation is about emphasizing the great things that also happen in traditional district schools. And one thing I don't like about the charter school debate is oftentimes it's a turf war battle. Mm-hmm. And in a turf war battle, the way that certain parts get their leverage is by putting down the other. And in the context of New Bedford, where we are a turnaround school and we are just trying to push the narrative around us being an underperforming school, for outside entities to come in and use our past underperformance as a reason for why there should be more seats in charter wasn't an acceptable thing for me. And so, you know, I'm obviously just talking to the unique context in my school, and I'll just leave it at I love traditional public schools. I grew up in traditional public schools.
All right.
You know,
looking down the road 10-15 years, what are some of the changes you hope will be in place in Massachusetts schools?
Greater diversity in the workforce, a greater emphasis on community, I think, and going back to this idea that like true school reform is one that engages the entire community. It's something that heals the community of the school, not just the school unit in and of itself. And so making sure that policies are not just attending to what's happening in the classroom, but also what's happening in the broader community at hand.
Mm-hmm. When you're looking at, MCAS and, test scores and things like that, when you have, students who, they want to go in this direction, but you've got to stick to that curriculum,
yeah,
right? Because you got to get those test scores. How much leeway do you have to follow a student's interest? You know, if your class is saying, hey, we want to learn about this,
yeah,
can you do that?
I think if you emphasize skills, then you can get there. And I am an AP teacher. And so, we teach to the test, mm-hmm, that is mandated by College Board. And on one hand, that's stifling because it feels like it is impinging on my freedom and ability to focus on certain things. On the other hand, it's a nice, broader goal. And it's good to get a sense of what other people are doing or what to align towards. And sometimes it's about finding that middle ground. And, mm-hmm, and you'll notice that be it MCAS, be it College Board and AP exams, the skills that they're assessing at the end of the day aren't content specific things, but broader pedagogical, what it means to analyze a text, for instance. And I'm only talking about English. And so there is a lot of room for creativity in getting there.
So what advice would you give teachers who, you're on the AP level, teachers in other schools and other districts and maybe other grades?
Mm-hmm.
What advice do you give to them?
In terms of
how to be the best teacher they can be. I mean, there's a lot of great teachers out there. There's,
yeah,
some teachers that maybe aren't so great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, do what you love, and it at the end of the day, it's really about the relationships and the kids. And sometimes it's easy to get lose sight of that, but if you can just focus on why you are in the classroom to begin with, and lean in on that love that you have for your craft of teaching, then everything else will fall into place, hopefully.
All right, so what do you say to the person who's considering a career, even a second career in teaching?
Do it. Do it. No, it's so gratifying. I say this a lot. The first day that I was in the classroom, I was more concerned with what I was going to wear the next day. Like, that's how selfish I was as a human being. And now these days, I'm thinking about what my curriculum is going to be like as I'm getting ready in the morning. I can't help but think this one interaction that I've had with this kid and how that's going to turn out the next day. And I truly think that being an educator means to be part of a community of people. And there's something so exciting about being part of that process of developing youth. And, it's something that makes us into better human beings.
It's an important job, a very important job. So just finally... fun too, yeah. But there's frustration, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we curriculum frustrations. We have, the frustration of, well, it's the school's fault. The school will do it. People who say, it's the school's responsibility to help raise my kids. Mm-hmm. So how do you deal with those frustrations?
I'm going to default back to my answer of community. Mm-hmm. I live with six other teachers. And being part of my own teacher community has been an important way to process a lot of the ways in which our job is frustrating. A lot of the ways in which our job is politicized. And I don't know how I would have made it to this point without having a community of practitioners who can hold me accountable, who can engage me in a conversation on what it means to be an educator in the United States today, and who can push me on my craft.
All right. Takeru Nagayoshi is the 2020 Massachusetts Teacher of the Year, English teacher at New Bedford High School. We'll put links with some of the top op-ed pieces he's written for various education publications at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks so much for coming in, and thanks for being the teacher that you are.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.